Prabhupada Paramahansa Hari Vrāja Gacharya Stavatari Svati Sri Srimad Divine Grace Kesi Bhakti Vedanta Goswami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Jaya Vishnu Prabhupada Paramahansa Hari Vrāja Gacharya Stavatari Svati Sri Srimad Divine Grace Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Ananta Koti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai ISKCON founder Acharya Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Namacharya Srila Haridas Thakur Ki Jai Premsaka Sri Krishna Chaitana Prabhu Nityananda Sri Adaita Gadara Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Krishna Govi Gopina Shyam Kunda Radha Kunda Gita Govardhan Ki Jai Sri Sri Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Sri Sri Navadvipa Dham Ki Jai Sri Sri Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Sri Sri Mathura Dham Ki Jai Sri Sri Jagannathpuri Dham Ki Jai Sri Sri Ayodhya Dham Ki Jai Tulasi Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Ganga Maya Ki Jai Jamuna Maya Ki Jai Gaur Premanandi Harinama Sankirtan Ki Jai Shri Shri Brihad Mridanga Ki Jai, Transcendental Prashadam Distribution Ki Jai. Shamaveta Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Shri Shinu Hastinapura Dhamma Ki Jai. All glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Shri Shri Guru and Shri Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Translations and purports by Divine Grace. A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. Third canto, 15th chapter, text number 14.
Vasanti. Yatra Purusha Sarve Vaikunta Murtayaha Ye Nimita Nimitena Dharminaradayan Haram Vasanti Yatra Purusha Vasanti Yatra Purusha Sarve Vaikuntha Murtaya Sarve Vaikuntha Murtaya Ye Nimitta Nimittena Ye Nimitta Nimittena Dharme Naradayan Harim Dharme Naradhayam Harim Vasanti Yatra Purusha Sarve Vaikuntha Murtaya Ye Nimitta Nimittena Dharme Naradhayam Harim Vasanti Yatra Purusha Sarve Vaikuntha Murtaya Ye Nimitta Nimittena Dharmena Radhayan Harim
Vasanti Yatra Purusha Sarve Vaikuntha Murtaya Sarve Vaikuntha Murtaya
Anything of it, just from your
Vasanti Yatra Purusha sarve vaikuntha mataya bhuvite
Maybe you can just rock your brain to see if you can read that. All right, well, we have about, I'm going to be coming over here to get the mess, so maybe I can pick it that way. Okay, do you have a copy of the Krishna Krishna
Ladies?
No, that's the last.
Managers?
She's been doing a new one today.
When?
She has just enough, so if you can make me a copy. Don't take one. Told me not to. Maybe you could put it in my box when you put your letter in the box, and I can
Sante
out. I looked on the bulletin board and they weren't there yet. No, I didn't see her. She left the temple early. Yeah. Well, if you could kind of check on it from that end.
Vasanti,
They
live. Yatra,
well, if she where?
Purusha, persons.
Yeah.
Sarve.
If you could make a copy of that, then that would be great. And I'll just Vaikuntha Murtaya. You know how to do it back to back when you're
having a four-handed form.
Okay, and then
similar to that of the Supreme Lord Vishnu. Yay. Those Vaikuntha persons. Animita, without desire for sense gratification.
You just check that scene out, you know.
Nimitena, caused by Dharmena, by devotional service. Aradhayan, continuously worshipping. Harim, unto the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Prabhupada's translation. In the Vaikuntha planets, all the residents are similar in form to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They all engage in devotional service to the Lord without desire for sense gratification. Responsively, in the Vaikuntha planets, all the residents are similar in form to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They all engage in devotional service to the Lord.
They all engage in devotional service to the Lord.
Without desires for sense gratification.
Without desires for sense gratification.
Purport by Srila Prabhupada. The residence and the form of living in Vaikuntha are described in this verse. The residents are all like the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan. In the Vaikuntha planets, Krishna's plenary feature as four-handed Narayan is the predominating deity. And the residents of Vaikuntha Loka are also four-handed, just contrary to our conception here in the material world. Nowhere in the material world do we find a human being with four hands. In Vaikuntha Loka, there is no occupation but the service of the Lord. And this service is not rendered with a purpose. Although every service has a particular result, the devotees never aspire for the fulfillment of their own desires. Their desires are fulfilled by rendering transcendental service to the Lord. Om Agnati Minanda Sagana Nandana Salakaya Chaksuran Vilitam Jena Tasmai Sri Guru Venamaha Sri Chaitanya Manovistam Stapidam Yena Bhutare Swayam Rupa Gadamayam Dharati Svaparantikam. Pure devotional service is being described here. It's service without any motivation or any ulterior motive, or as Prabhupada says, without any desires of one's own, without fulfillment for one's desires. In the material world, everything is done with a motive for some personal aggrandizement or personal success. So just as we have no evidence, no examples of any four-handed beings, this doesn't fit within the scheme of Darwinian evolution, no four-handed human beings anyway. We have no examples of service that is being rendered selflessly in the material world. Everything is based on trade or reciprocation or gaining something personal. And in the non-material world, which is three-quarters of the cosmos, the living beings are acting causelessly in service for the Lord. They're acting only to please His desires, to please Him, and their desires are non-different from His desires. So therefore, Krishna is worshipped as Rishika Isha, or Rishikesha, the master. Isha is the senses, and Rishika are the senses, and Isha, or Ishwara, is the master. So when we say Rishikena, Rishikesha, Rishikesha, Rishikena, Sevanam, we're asking that we be purified. This is a verse from the Narada Pancharatna, Pancharatra. This is a verse that asks us, Sarva Parivinir Muktam, to be freed of unwanted things or unwanted desires, and to engage ourselves in the service of the senses of the Lord, because He's the master of the senses. When His senses are pleased, then and only then can our senses be pleased, because our senses are never satisfied. The more one tries to satisfy one's senses, the more they become, voracious? They just increase more and more and more and more. And they can never be satisfied, just like the itching. It just keeps itching. The more you scratch it, the more it keeps itching and itching and itching. So these simple things, the senses, which we kind of take for granted or don't really understand what they are, they're voracious, as Bhaktivinoda Thakura describes them in his prayer, Sarirada Vijaya, all the senses. And the tongue of all of them is the most voracious. Voracious means the appetite is so strong that it can never be satisfied. So as soon as you give the senses a little something, they want more. And you give them something, they want more and more and more and more. They're never actually satisfied. So it's the same with service. The more one does, the more one wants. The material world is based on, if you're successful, you have a bigger salary, a bigger boat, a bigger house, a bigger car, bigger family, a bigger community, a bigger position. And there's never enough. As soon as one reaches the pinnacle of his success, that desired goal he always waited for, he became the number one world-class high jumper or concert pianist, then it's never enough, because somebody's always better, somebody's always got more, and besides, it's not going to last. So in the spiritual world, the beings are different, because they're completely in tune with the desires for the Lord. And in pure devotional service, which we have the privilege of engaging in, there's no desire even for liberation. The living beings, liberation is also a kind of material desire. The living beings want artha, dharma, moksha, karma, kama. Sense desire, kama. Artha, they want economic development. Dharma, they want to fulfill some particular duty very well. And lastly, they want liberation. And liberation is often a very materialistically oriented thing. What is liberation? Once when I was in England, there was a radio program we used to hear about. It was about, it was called The Clitheroe Kid. It was a comedy. It was about a young boy who just had adventures and saw things from a child's viewpoint. So on one of the episodes, it was shortly after the devotees had arrived, he was having a real hard time with his parents and he was threatening to leave home. So he said to his mother, I think I'm just going to go out and join him dancing in the street. And it was referring to us, of course, because we were very popular with our Hare Krishna mantra record had just come out. So that's the way the conditioned souls think of liberation. They just want to get rid of it all. And one of the ways they think they can get liberated is by suicide. A lot of people think they'll just commit suicide. It's a very common practice nowadays. And that will be liberation. I'll be liberated from all this hardship, all this stress, all this anxiety, all the difficulty in the material world. What they don't know from our esoteric picture in the Bhagavatam, which it shows, is that there are beings waiting to take them away and torture them. Someone once told me they wanted to give it was a sick joke, a kind of macabre sick joke, a condolence card to some departed relative by using that picture of the conditioned soul lying in bed and Yamadutas are, you know, reaching behind like that. So that's their idea of liberation. And it's very commonplace for even those who are steeped in the Vedic literature to think that sometime after I've done my life and my family and my business is wound up and I'll retire, which they never retire from, most of them. Not really. I mean, they might let the children take over the business, but they're always, you know, concerned, always thinking about it, always staying at home, being kept, as the Bhagavatam says, like a kept dog, where they're throwing some remnants of foodstuffs and they're sort of wasting, rotting away in the material world. They think they'll go to the Himalayas in later life. They think, you know, I'll get so old, and then they have this kind of dream, this notion, just like people, they watch television and they think that someday they're going to get so many miles on their credit card or whatever, and they're going to fly to the Bahamas, or they're going to go to Hawaii, or they'll go to the Maldives or some exotic destination. So they think, if they're steeped in Vedic culture, that they'll go to the Himalayas, and at that stage they'll get liberated, and they'll go away, and they'll live in the snow and meet a holy man and all that sort of stuff. And of course they never do, because as they get old they tend to become feeble and infirm and senile, and they just never get it together. So Prabhupada uses the word rotting. It's a very heavy word, but it's actually a very accurate word. People are rotting. It's like the bodies, you know, they're rotting. I heard a tape recently where Prabhupada was saying, people are always greeting each other in the material world. How are you? Fine. Are you everything right? I'm nice, very nice. How nice? You're going to die. Tomorrow, probably. Another time someone asked him, what do you think of healthy? It was in Bombay on a big pondo. And what does your movement think of health? So Prabhupada said, nobody is healthy, everybody's dying. So, of course, Prabhupada was very cutting, as only a sadhu of his stature, a Mahabhagavat, can be. But he was distinguishing always between pure devotional service, in which these elements of time and false ideas of liberation don't take place. So devotees are not really interested in liberation. There's a statement, I think it's by Bill Mongol Thakur, that liberation is begging at the doorstep of a devotee. It's not an issue for a devotee. And there are different kinds of liberation. It's like there's this type of liberation where one can become a swarupya, or have a form like the Lord. One can also be a personal associate of the Lord, samipya. One can merge with the Lord, shastri or ekatvam. There's different kinds of liberation. And one can also be liberated, salokya, can live on the same planet of the Lord. And if one is very fortunate, one can get pure devotional service, attain his original swarupa, and relate eternally with the Lord. But even these kinds of liberation, it's stated in the Bhagavatam, are not, even though the Lord personally will grant such things, they're not interested in accepting any kind of benedictions. The Lord offers benedictions to different types of devotees. And they're not interested in them, because they realize that whatever benedictions they may be, there's, even if the Lord himself personally grants them, there's nothing that that satisfies the soul more than selfless service, service that is pure. It has no motivation and it's unending. All service has a beginning and an end, but devotional service has no beginning and has no end. It just continues because it's our eternal nature. It's our eternal dharma. So devotees, when they come to Vaikuntha, as is mentioned here, they're in the place where there's no anxiety. Kunta is the material world characterized by anxiety, and Vaikuntha is a place where no one experiences anxiety. And even if there's anxiety in the material world, and we have to live in it as devotees, that anxiety of the material world becomes like the spiritual world. And the anxiety of the material world becomes reduced down to the size of a water in a calf's footprint. The ocean of material existence, is said, is reduced to that size. So in pure devotional service, wherever one is, one feels very satisfied. And actually, everybody's engaging in some kind of service all the time. It has to be done. So an intelligent person understands that ultimately all service, manushya patha sarva shaha, is going to Krishna. In the spiritual world, because everything is spiritual and everything is conscious, all the beings are always in a blissful, happy state of mind. We were watching this Poland yatra by Indraduna Maharaj yesterday, and it was just wonderful to see. It's the kind of thing that once you start watching, you just sort of can't take your eyes off. See devotees are constantly dancing and chanting, and people are dancing and chanting with them. And it's just so attractive, you can't really stop watching it or hearing it. And the spiritual world is actually like that. There's no such thing as just, you know, watching, but every step is a dance. There's no such thing as just drinking water. Everything is sweet and beautiful and nectar, tastes like nectar. And there's no just speaking, like, you know, it's kind of like I'm talking, it's a little bit sing-song. Usually somebody's falling asleep today. Maybe I'm lucky. But in the spiritual world, it's not like that. Everything is beautiful. Everything is being sung, being chanted very, very melodiously. Even the birds are singing. When Lord Chaitanya went to Vrindavan, of course, the spiritual world, Vaikuntha world, manifested there. The birds, the parrots, were reciting verses from the Govinda Lilamrita. The male parrot was reciting verses in glorification of Lord Krishna. A female parrot was reciting verses in glorification from the Govinda Lilamrita about Radharani. So in the spiritual world, everything is conscious. The birds can sing beautiful Sanskrit verses. Also, when Lord Chaitanya was going to that part of the world in Boma Vrindavan, it was described how all the animals were so attracted to him. They were manifesting their original spiritual swarupas or tendencies by being in association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Chaitanya, the cows were following him, the deer were following him, they were licking him and licking his body as if they could not be satiated. Tears were manifesting in their eyes just like they were human beings because their natural dormant love of God was being aroused. So everything in the spiritual world is conscious. The hills, stones, the water, everything is fully conscious. And as described in the Krishna book also, when Krishna was walking through the forest, all the trees were bowing down. And when Lord Chaitanya was walking also through Vrindavan, it appeared that the trees were bowing down as if in a mood and a gesture of supplication and offering them their flowers and their fruits and their leaves. And they were also crying, it is mentioned, and that was manifest in the form of dripping honey. So these are the natural spiritual tendencies of all the living beings, to make offerings to the Lord, to engage in pure devotional service, and to constantly exhibit ecstatic symptoms, like crying, like making offerings. Sometimes we saw the followers, the pure devotees of Lord Chaitanya, they would be completely detached from their bodies. They would roll around on the floor, they would embrace, they would cry, they would laugh, and they would exhibit all extraordinary symptoms which are characteristic of the spiritual world. So real liberation is, at least for devotees, is that liberation in which we attain to the spiritual world in our original form and engage in continuous, unmotivated, uninterrupted devotional service. Even when one renders service in this material world, one feels very ecstatic, savai pumsam paro dharma, because this is the eternal dharma. This is the dharma which is not kaitava, or cheating dharma, but the ultimate dharma, not the dharma which Krishna instructs us to give up, sarva dharmam parityaja, but the ultimate dharma. That's devotional service. And in the purport to that verse, savai pumsam paro dharma, yatir bhakti yat hok sujay, Oituki apritiyata ye atmam supersedati. Prabhupada writes that when there is service between any persons, it is very relishable. Even in the material world, there's something relishable about service and being served. And in the spiritual world, it is very pure. And Prabhupada states that the relationship between the server and the served is the most confidential form of intimacy. So a very intimate relationship develops between Vaishnavas because they're all worshipping Krishna together. At least it's meant to be very intimate. If the relationship is not intimate, then there's something missing or something at fault. The relationship is so important that it occupies the first two parts of the Vedanta Sutra. It's in four parts. And the first two parts are about sambandha. The third part is Abhideya and the fourth part is Prayojana. So the relationships is so important. It's given all this. Sometimes, not sometimes, but maybe very often, one finds that to misconstrue relationships and think that the spiritual world is the exclusive property of devotees of Krishna. Now, in one sense, we know it is, because one has to engage in devotional service to get there. But the vision of the Majjhima Adhikari is to see that others are also, although indirectly, engaged in devotional service. I want to read a couple of passages from the Chaitanya Chaitamrita that touch on this point. In the 17th chapter, Prabhupada writes in his purports about Lord Chaitanya's association with some of the temples and devotees in Vrindavan. So he writes about the fact that ISKCON, for example, when I say for example, I mean as the modern day manifestation of the Brahma Madhya Gaudiya Sampradaya, is very exclusivist in that one has to be in pure devotional service, following strictly in the line of the acharyas without making any deviations in devotional service to actually be successful. At the same time, because the preaching of this sampradaya is that all religion is one, or that there's only one God, and that manusha partha sarvasha, that everyone is engaged in the service of Krishna directly or indirectly, and that the essence of all religion is love of God, there's also an ecumenical aspect of ISKCON that is not at all exclusivist, but it embraces all religions and all worshippers of the Lord. So these are some of Prabhupada's reflections on this. This is the purport to the 184th text, the 17th chapter of Madhya Lila. The text reads, Prabhu kahe shruta smriti yata rishi gan, sabai eka mata nahe bina bina dharm. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu replied, the Vedas, Puranas, and great learned sages are not always in agreement with one another. Consequently, there are different religious principles. And the purport, he writes, Prabhupada writes, unless one comes to the absolute truth, there is no possibility of agreement. Nashavrishir yasya matam nibinam. This is a famous verse which ends in Mahajano yena gatasva panta. And Prabhupada translates that as, dry arguments are inconclusive. A great personality whose opinion does not differ from others is not considered a great sage. Simply by studying the Vedas, which are variegated, one cannot come to the right path by which religious principles are understood. The solid truth of religious principles is hidden in the heart of an unadulterated, realized person. Consequently, as the Shastras confirm, one should accept whatever progressive path the Mahajans dictate or advocate. So he continues in this 184th verse purport. It is said that a great learned scholar or sage cannot be exalted unless he disagrees. On the material platform, there is no possibility of agreement. It's quite obvious that even though billions and billions have been spent in conferences for United Nations peace meetings and seminars and feeding the world and agriculture and so on, actually they never succeed, they never agree. And even though they should, there's probably something like 20 or 30 major armed conflicts going on in the world right now. What to speak of all the different philosophers and movements and ideas that are all vying against one another in a constant tower of Babel that never reaches any conclusion. On the material platform, there is no possibility of agreement. Therefore, there are different kinds of religious systems. However, the absolute truth is one. And when one is situated in the absolute truth, there is no disagreement. On that absolute platform, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is worshipable. So this is the difference between pure devotional service and religious sentiment. If religion is not pure, then people are automatically committing many different types of aparads in the name of their religion. So as Prabhupada often said, unless pure love of Godhead is inculcated or practiced, or somehow we induce people to undergo the purificatory process of chanting, which is the beginning of pure devotional service, then there must be disagreement. Recently, Shonaka Rishi held a conference in England. It was an interfaith. It was at the Manor, Bhaktivedanta Manor. And some of the major players in the Church of England and among the Methodists were there. And they have such a hard time just accepting the fact, most of them don't, except that there's reincarnation. They can't even go past that very basic concept that the soul and body are different. So it's very difficult to understand how people can engage in devotional service when they're very attached to a particular religious system. It's very difficult unless they begin to chant with some faith the Hare Krishna mantra. On that absolute platform, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is worshipable. As stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhakti Mama Vijanati Yavanyash Tashmi Tatvataha, on the absolute platform, the worshipful deity is one, and the process of worship is one. The process is bhakti. So in the introduction of Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada quotes, I think, from that Jayadeva verse where he says there should be one song, right? Remember that? And one prayer, one scripture. And what is it? There's one other thing. One prayer, one scripture, one song, one activity. And the result, the fifth thing, is there will be one world. So the scripture, of course, is Bhagavad Gita. The activity is devotional service. The song is the Hare Krishna mantra. The prayer is to serve Krishna. So that's the real basis of one, when one can engage in devotional service purely. There are many different religions throughout the world. Because they are not all on the absolute platform of devotional service throughout the world. Yeah, because they're not on the absolute platform of devotional service. As confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Sarva Dharman Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Braja. The word Ekam means one, Krishna. On this platform, there are no different religious systems. According to Srimad Bhagavatam, Dharma Projita Kaitava Tra, on the material platform, religious systems are different. So the word Kaitava means actually cheating. So the Bhagavatam is very heavy in this regard. If one isn't actually engaged in devotional service purely, because maybe he's eating meat or he doesn't believe in reincarnation, these are cheating religions. They're all actually cheating. Dharma Projita Kaitavotra. On the material platform, religious systems are different. Srimad Bhagavatam describes them from the very beginning as Dharma Kaitava, cheating religions. None of these religions are actually genuine. The genuine religious system is that which enables one to become a lover of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the words of Srimad Bhagavatam, then he quotes, Savai Pumso Paro Dharmo. And his translation is, the supreme occupation Dharma for all humanity is that by which men can attain to loving service unto the transcendent Lord. Such devotional service must be unmotivated and uninterrupted to completely satisfy the self. Then Prabhupada continues, on this platform there is nothing but the service of the Lord. When a person has no ulterior motive, there is certainly oneness and agreement of principles. Since everyone has a different body and mind, different types of religions are needed. But when one is situated on the spiritual platform, there are no bodily or mental differences. Consequently, on the absolute platform, there is oneness in religion. So this is a very nice way that Prabhupada has addressed the question of our sometimes comes up. Are we exclusivists? Or do we say that there is only one God and everyone can approach him? In other words, can we go to ecumenical conferences? Can we participate? Actually, for the people who are really serious academic students of various faiths who really study their scriptures, they consider that if we water down Krishna consciousness, that if we don't actually say the essence of Krishna consciousness, that we have to exclusively worship Krishna as the supreme being. They think that we're guilty of what they call syncretism. In interfaith circles, that means diluting your philosophy to make it sound as if you're completely in sync with the other religions, or in some cases, if you're a minority, it would be the host religion. So they actually can appreciate. And they also can appreciate that in Krishna consciousness, by being very faithful to our shastras and living by them, that we're contributing something to the theology of a particular region or a particular place. These concepts of pure devotional service, of God as a person with attributes, of the soul being different from the body, and so forth, these are foreign to any other than the Vedic culture, for, by and large. I mean, there may be some small exceptions. But it's a contribution, a very important contribution to the understanding of the theology and metaphysics of the planet. So in that way, ISKCON does have something very important to contribute. But at the same time, as Prabhupada indicates, a devotee should never compromise. He should never find some meaning that doesn't actually exist in the shastras. Shouldn't make some false meaning. And a devotee is also meant to aspire constantly for pure devotional service and not desire to be liberated in any one of the five forms or in any one of the more perverse or uninformed methods of liberation, like just throwing away one's money or walking around naked. Yeah, these are ways that people think they're being liberated. Or by through sexual union, they think that's liberation. Once Prabhupada took us to Stanford University when we were just beginners in 1967. And we had a big kirtan, very ecstatic kirtan. Some of the students came up to us, and one of them was just, you know, completely in ecstasy, completely in bliss. He said, "Isn't this the same as having sex? It's so wonderful." So people have no idea, you know, what liberation really means, what getting out of the material world means. And what they think is getting out of the material world is usually getting more and more immersed in the material world. Because whatever you enjoy, it's an addiction. No matter how beautiful the music might sound, no matter how classical and pristine it may be, or one's desires are, it's not pure devotional service. So without those qualities, harava bhaktas, what is it? Harava bhaktasya kuto mahaguna manorantena sati davatovahi. Without those qualities, the good qualities of pure devotional service, one is considered by the Bhagavatam to have no good qualities. One just doesn't have them. They're not there. He's not a bhakta. And without those qualities, one is actually forced to act under the external energy, manoratena sati davatovihi, under the control of the mind and the external energy of the Lord. One is a slave to that external energy if one isn't engaged in pure devotional service. So Prabhupada is talking about the every service has a particular result. The devotees never aspire for the fulfillment of their own desires. Their desires are fulfilled by the rendering of transcendental loving service to the Lord. Asanti yatra purusha sarve vaikunta murtaya ye nimita nimitena dharme naradhayan harim. In the Vaikuntha planets, all the residents are similar in form to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They all engage in devotional service to the Lord without desire for sense gratification. Any questions or comments? Yes, Anchita.
Just one question that we don't understand. On the one hand, we say that Krishna is not wrong, so he's self-satisfied without needing anything else to be satisfied. Then we say that Rishikesh say that when you satisfy Krishna, then you become satisfied. So on the surface, it seems like a contradiction. Mm-hmm. Krishna is already satisfied, and when it's parsa parsa, then we should also be satisfied. Why do we have to do something else to satisfy him so that we become satisfied?
Yeah. That's because in the material world, we have no such thing as perfect, more perfect and most perfect. Perfect is perfect, and that's the definition. And fully satisfied, according to material calculation, means fully satisfied. Nobody can satisfy you anymore. So when we speak of Krishna as being fully satisfied, we're speaking of transcendental satisfaction, in which although Krishna is not only fully satisfied, he's also fully loved. He's so fully loved, and he's so full of love, that it's sometimes said that he can only enjoy himself. There's that famous instance where he's on the palm leaf as a little child. He's sucking his toe. He's drinking the nectar of his own body. So that's ultimately it's a chincha to try to understand how one can be satisfied and still derive satisfaction. Another aspect of that is Krishna is the supreme lover, and let's say the supreme controller. Ishwar is the supreme controller. He controls all the universes. He controls all the movements of even the blades of grass. Nothing can move without his sanction, and yet he's controlled by the love of his devotees. When he was trying to hide his Narayan form, he couldn't conceal it to Radharani, even though he tried. So somehow this is also taking place in a very mystical way, that he's the supreme controller, yet he's controlled by the love of his devotees. And he's the supreme ultimate being, he's the highest being, he's the Ishwara, he's Roktarang Jagatapasam, the supreme enjoyer, the supreme controller, the supreme owner. And yet it's said that the devotees own him, or they can possess him, like Mother Yashoda. She can bind him. He lets himself be bound. So it's actually inconceivable that one can satisfy the one who's already satisfied. But he's not only satisfied, but he relishes this satisfaction so much that there's nothing he wants more. And for this reason, he never steps foot in his original form out of Vaikuntha. Because that satisfaction, because of that service that his devotees render him, makes him stay there. It imprisons him, so to speak, in its original form in Krishna Loka. So it's very mystical to understand how the supreme satisfied Atmarama, supreme Lord, can be satisfied. And yet the satisfaction is so great that the devotee who serves the Lord becomes so well reciprocated by that, becomes so satisfied that he actually is able to serve and satisfy someone else without needing anything back at all except the act of service itself, which is considered to be its own reward. So ultimately it's just completely, it's inconceivable. Achintya. But because we're venturing into the, we're tiptoeing into the inconceivable realm, we're supposed to be living in that realm, we're trying to meditate on these inconceivable things and bring them into the realm of our present reality, which doesn't allow for any such thinking. And thereby, therefore, we sometimes become criticized as being unrealistic, seekers of personal, otherworldly salvation, which doesn't exist, and exclusivist. So it's a difficult job, actually, to bridge that gap between us as devotees and everyone else who we're supposed to see as devotees. Sometimes it becomes very difficult. And this, I was reading Priyavrata's recent, he wrote a paper for the ISKCON Communications Journal. He was saying how this problem has become a kind of endemic, is that the word, a very pervasive problem in our society. That somehow we, even though we know everyone's a spirit soul and we're supposed to envelop them and in devotional service somehow and induce them, we tend to kind of shrink back away, and therefore people see us as a cult. It's a very interesting paper. I mean, there's a lot more to it than that, but it's one of the problems we face. Yes?
I'm glad you brought that up, because part of the problem as I see it is that we don't know how to go fishing without getting wet. See, yeah. Prabhupada would mix with the common people, but he would never, ever compromise on what he would do personally. Like if somebody offered him something that was not offered, he wouldn't eat it. But we become a little victimized that here I am, I'm having with the National Council, where they're now they're passing something, and I'm going to feel bad if I don't eat it. Or, Prabhupada didn't have any such problem. He would just absolutely say no. He'd just move on. But he was so nice that he didn't disturb people.
Well, sometimes he would just take it in a gracious way. I was with him once, and somebody gave him something. He just took it and sort of put it away. So that's the art. It's an art. To be in the world but not of the world. It's a great art. It's not an easy thing to achieve. And yes, let's just see. We're always trying to figure out exactly how to do it.
Yeah, why are we delineating? Why has it been delineated in so many scriptures, so many books, and so much detail? And how can we expect to understand it? It's inconceivable.
Yeah. Well, it's not actually inconceivable for us. Inconceivable means it's inconceivable in my material calculation. That way it's inconceivable. That's the meaning of it. Just like achintya, beta beta tattva, which is the most commonly used way achintya is used. One cannot, in the material sense, comprehend two things that compute, doesn't compute, that are one and yet they're not one. And that confuses even a lot of followers of the Vedas, the Advaitas. Everything has to be one because it's not possible that something can be one and different simultaneously. Or just like when we were in school, we were taught that, in philosophy classes anyway, that there's either free will or predestination. You can't have both things. You can't be, it's not that everything can be determined, and then if it is, then you can't have any free will. But in Krishna consciousness, we gradually learn in Krishna consciousness that there is free will. The Lord gives us free will, but at the same time, he gives us restriction. And Prabhupada uses a very common example. You can't drive in this country on the left side of the road with freedom. You can do it, but your freedom is going to be very limited. So in that very simple, almost simplistic way, we can conceive of the inconceivable, but there's a certain amount of non-exclusivity in free will and predestiny. So everything in devotional service is inconceivable from the material point of view. In one sense, like we're talking to Radha Madan Mohan, and we're expecting that this form of stone, apparently, is going to hear what we're saying. And that's madness to a conditioned soul. You're going to talk to the stone, and he's going to hear you. You're going to chant the holy name, and somehow it's going to reach, you know, billions of miles away to the spiritual world, and it's going to be heard. Or it's coming from there down to us. These things make no sense from the material point of view. So by trying to understand what these things are and how they work and how to do them, we're actually engaged in the process of training ourselves to think transcendentally or rehearsing for existence in the spiritual world, where all thinking is completely spiritual. We're all, the whole process of action and thinking and feeling is on a spiritual platform, and nothing is actually inconceivable. So when we speak of inconceivable, we're speaking of our usual way of thinking, which is very narrow, actually very narrow. And there's that verse, Atmavan Manyate Jagat, that we tend to always see everything in terms of the way our own mind works. So in our contaminated stage, we have to get purified so that is actually, I think you quoted this verse once, it's actually a form of meditation. Aradhananam Sarvesham. It's if we meditate on the things that are connected with Vishnu,